Hi everyone, you are listening to the Accents podcast on WUKY. I am your host, Katerina Stoikova, and today with me is poet, essayist, and teacher, Kathleen Driscoll, Kentucky's 2025-2026 Poet Laureate. Hi Kathleen, and welcome to Accents.
Hi Katerina, thanks for having me.
We've done this a few times,
yes? Yeah, we have. It feels like I'm having coffee with you around on my kitchen table.
I think we have had an Accents interview over the years at least 5 or 6 times.
You think?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, feels pretty comfortable, yeah. So I believe it.
We have so much to report on. Last time we spoke, your chapbook, The Vine Temple, was just out. And today I'm holding your latest full-length book, Goat-Footed Gods. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I love your book. There are elements in this book that are similar to other books and elements that are different, new to me. Would you speak to that, please?
Well, I think I'm always writing about mortality. I think that's my flood subject, as Emily Dickinson used to say. I think my flood setting is around my home, about a square mile around my home. I never seem to tire of looking very closely in interesting ways it allows me, even in that confined space or what seems like a pretty, truncated space, it really helps me think about the world, and I find that I can write about anything I want to write about. So in this book, I'm writing about that territory again that's close to my home, at least in large part. I'm writing about the train trestle on the road where I live, Poplic Trestle, which is probably not so famous in this part of the country, but in Louisville, it's pretty well known because that's where the cryptid, never thought I'd be writing about cryptids, but that's where the cryptid, the goat man, is said to live and haunt the area. And in fact, the lore is for legend trippers, if they go up to the trestle, which is about 8 stories high at its center, and they walk out to the middle, they can conjure the goat man. They can lure the goat man out. And so we've lived in our home, which is in an old country church that was built before the Civil War, for almost 30 years now. And since we've lived there, I would say 4 or 5 young people have done this, and then a train has come unexpectedly and caught them and knocked them to their deaths. So I'm not in any way saying that I am, you know, as affected or as aggrieved as their families or friends. I don't really know these people, but it does affect a community, and it's something to live with. And the last young woman, who was a teenager, I think she was 15 or 16, was knocked from the bridge. It was just a horrible, horrible thing. And there's a little memorial below the trestle that I walk by a lot with my dog when I'm walking my dog. And so she caught my attention. I just couldn't stop thinking about her. And so I wanted to write about that. And about the same time, my daughter in 2020 had a terrible fall, and from a second-story deck. She was at a friend's house, and no one else was very hurt, but she came straight down, and she shattered her T12. And she was in Chandler for a long time, and so I was dealing with that. And she's ambulatory now, but her life has changed. She's disabled. Thinking about falls, those two falls going together, one, I'm not trying to put any blame on people, but one is sort of seeking out trouble, and the other is, not expecting trouble, but having this devastating thing happen to her, to my daughter and me. So I kind of, bounced around those two ideas a lot and put them together. And then I also thought about, the goat man is a kind of a figure that's born out of Pan and Western religion's fear of all things mythical, or our need to create these kind of crazy monsters. And, why are we going to look for this when we should, we can look over our shoulders and find really terrible things. We all know this right now, really terrible things that are happening, and those should be getting our attention, I think. So the book is about that. And so I also took an opportunity to try to redeem the reputation of Pan. Mm-hmm. A little bit. So there's some poems where I've written some hymns. They're not informal in the formal verse that we think about hymns being. They're sort of my spin on it. I'm not really a formal poet. I don't really have any interest in writing in form, but I am always informed by the concepts of form, what they mean. And so I thought it might be nice to write some hymns. So there are, I don't know, three or so in the book. And then I have some poems where I make fun of the Greek male gods. So I was just trying to lighten the book up a little bit. I always think I'm lightening up my book, and it just turns out to be dark in a new way. So
writing about gods and at the same time stating almost in the same breath that you do not believe in any gods. Why the fascination then?
I don't know. You know, I recently was asked to, last Saturday, I was asked to read a poem at the commencement of Spalding University, our big commencement, where Governor Beshear was our commencement speaker. So that was kind of thrilling to see him again, because he was so wonderfully present at Kentucky Writers' Day and when I was installed as Kentucky Poet Laureate. And so I was looking for a poem that was not too profane or sacrilegious, and so I ended up having to rewrite something a little bit. But I am, what I find divine is the natural world, and I don't really believe anything supernatural. I never have. I remember being a little kid, being with my grandmother in a Quaker church, which is, you know, pretty progressive in a lot of ways, and just thinking, this is not for me. I don't get this at all. So it's just the way I'm built. But that doesn't mean I don't have a fascination with it. And then moving into this church, I'm always sort of bumping up against, you know, these traditions. I mean, every day I'm in church, and next door is a graveyard, a little graveyard that I live next to, and people, it's, you know, Mount Zion Lutheran Cemetery, and so it's full of people, I would assume, you know, who are believers, and so I'm just constantly sort of rubbing up against this or thinking about it. So, no, I'm not a believer, but thinking about religion and why people follow certain doctrine and why people are, you know, convinced that Orthodox ways are the best ways. It's just always been endlessly fascinating to me. So that's the best answer I got for you.
That's a fine answer. And as in other books, family members make appearance. So tell us about the joys and complexities of writing about family.
This was an interesting project because I did want to write about Quinn, my daughter, but I didn't want to take her story away from her. But you know, I was in the hospital with her. I was in the emergency room with her. I'm her mother, you know. So this thing happened to her, and while I don't want to infringe on her privacy, and I asked her to read the book to see if it was okay, and she's, you know, she's the sort of daughter that whatever I want to do is okay. So that was kind of really supportive and great. But I have there's always a flip side, you know. I was a witness to this too, and so you know, I feel like as long as I'm respectful of her privacy, and I think I kind of know her boundaries, and that's true of other family members too. I mean, there's a lot I can't tell. I don't feel comfortable telling, but what I do tell, I feel is half mine at least, and that I haven't hurt anybody by telling it. I'm just trying to probe the human condition, really, and what it means to be connected to other people. So,
and there are memoir style poems here. It feels more than another books. Would you agree with me?
I think so. That's a great thing to point out. After COVID or during COVID, when COVID came, we may have talked about this before, all my poems just dried up. I don't know what was happening, but I've heard other writers say this. You know,
it's how seasonal, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, what do I have to say that could be of any import in this devastating time? And when people are losing their loved ones right and left, and oh, it's just terrible. So I thought, well, I'm going to teach myself how to write essays. So, and I do think that poetry and creative nonfiction, memoir, essays, I think they come from the same sensibility. So I felt pretty comfortable doing that. And I thought, well, maybe if I give myself a little more room to move around in an essay, more words, I'll be able to find something interesting to say, and that doesn't, I don't know. I don't know what it was. I mean, poems, you know, hold our hearts, so what could be more important than that? But I can see that essay writing has influenced my poems, too. I'm not trying to make them too prosy. I'm not really interested in writing prose poems. I know some people love that. It's just not something I'm interested in, but to give myself a little more room, I guess, in memoir. I don't know. So,
I don't think they're any prosier. I think they're more intimate, just like how Silas House describes them in the blurb.
Oh, yeah, I guess so. Maybe the older I get, the freer I get, you know, or maybe the older I get, I figure I better say it now. If I haven't said it already, I haven't said it now. But, you know, it's a little hypocritical of me not to try to drive toward the truth or true feelings. I'm not talking about facts. I'm talking about truth, trying to get after that. You know, when I ask my students to do the same, when I tell them this is what makes a poem has to risk. All pieces of writing have to risk something. And otherwise, you're just reiterating what someone else has said. And that may be fine for you, and that's a great practice. But if you want to share it with the world and have a readership and whatever, I think you have to try to say something new or at least deeply authentic to you. And how can something that's deeply authentic to you not be something new to someone else, right? We all have our own experiences.
I have quoted you so many times.
Ah!
You say, we write our way to truth.
Yeah. Sometimes people tell me what I said, and I was like, did I say that?
You did. I even quoted you in a poem of mine.
Okay.
I would love to hear several poems.
Okay.
I mean, since we spoke about those poems, maybe the one with the girl's fall, the 15-year-old girl's fall.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Then maybe if you feel comfortable about Quinn's fall.
Sure.
And then I have those two listing.
Mm-hmm.
On page 56 and homonyms on page 60.
Okay, well, this is called After the Fall. And I should read the epigraph, if you don't mind.
Of course.
That's in the front of the book. And I've put four of them in front of the book trying to set the context so people will have a little grounding for it. So this is from the Washington Post, April 26, 2016. And so, despite the warning signs and a tall fence that surrounds the trestle, Pope Creek has had several accidents and deaths, some possibly related to the goat man. Looking for the goat man, this satyr holds the tragic distinction of being one of the most dangerous mythical animals in North America. And then the short one, which is a headline from the Louisville Courier-Journal, May 28, 2019. A 15-year-old girl dies in yet another train accident on the Public Trestle. So when I published this poem earlier, that epigraph about her was included here. After the fall. At the park path near my home, my dog stops always to sniff around her makeshift memorial, a plastic wreath, a laminated poster with her photo at the foot of the train trestle from which she fell. I look up, 90 feet towering over, the equivalent of falling from a building with 8 floors. Each time I pass by, I wonder what in the world could have urged her onto the tracks that night. What dare, what thing was she looking for? And did she find it before she heard the whistle? Had she not stepped under the trestle that evening, had the train not been coming, perhaps she'd be living in a dorm that high. There's a tower like that at the university my daughter attended. Or the girl might be working in an office building. When time for her break, she pushes back from her metal desk, catches a glimpse down 8 stories to the street below. All busyness stopped for a moment at the red light. The delivery trucks idling, the bicyclists balancing, keen to wheel on. Perhaps, forehead on cold glass, she shudders, feeling a little dizzy. What might that fall be like? At whose feet might she land before? Someone hurrying home with a birthday cake with blue icing or a bouquet of hydrangeas. And what of their celebrations then? We hear the sirens while out on the screen porch, rosé wine in hand on a warm Saturday night, dog curled at our feet, when in a fallow field beneath the trestle, the policewoman, our neighbor, with teenagers of her own at home, or so she thinks, walks toward a patch of crushed blonde grass. In the byline of the newspaper article the next day, I read the name of my student. She's the reporter called to talk to witnesses. She makes notes standing beside the stream that has always run under the trestle. A slow rain begins to pock the water. We hear it too, striking our porch's red metal roof.
Oh, gorgeous.
Thank you.
And heartbreaking at the same time. Thank you.
So here's another poem, the poem that you were mentioning, Listing. And it also, I think it kind of gets at the, is it my story? Is it Quinn's story? Listing. After the accident, I should say her accident, I stood by her bed all night and pulled twigs and bits of dried leaves from her curly brown hair and sat in a hard chair in vigil, watched as the aides in bright blue scrubs wheeled her bed out of the emergency room bay again and again and down the narrow hall where, though the door was closed, I heard her scream each time they lifted her onto the table for another MRI. And I watched the clock for morphine. And overnight, I watched the clock and wait for the neurosurgeon to wake from his soft bed, for his coffee to finish dripping into a pot, for him to kiss his children goodbye as they ran off to the school bus, for his finger to wheel through his texts, willed him to see that it was she who needed him most very first that morning. I waited and ticked down the list of things I would give up for her. And even after I got to walking, I went on.
It hits me differently when I hear it from you.
Yeah, it was a hard time. You know, it was during COVID too. And not to say too much about this, but when we got the call, we were in Louisville and we raced to Lexington, which is where she was living. And you know, we got to the emergency room doors and they were like, only one of you can come in and whoever comes in cannot leave. You have to stay, you know. And I sort of pushed my husband out of the way and said, get out of my way. I'm going. So, you know, once I was there, I was there. And of course, I wanted to help her and be there. No, but
I would have done the same thing.
Of course. That's what I said. Later when my husband was like, yeah, you kind of got a little rough with me there. I was like, well, mother bear.
Would you read homonyms?
Yeah, sure. I remember this happening to me so vividly still. I don't have a great memory, but I really remember this. And it was when I just, it was when language sort of struck me like lightning. And not just language, but the figurative, which is what I've always loved about writing and why I was called to poetry probably, rather than most other genres. Not that they don't have figurative language, but we really love the figurative as poets. Homonyms. In school, first grade perhaps, maybe second, we are studying language, homonyms. Now they are called homophones, I think. Each child is asked to make a poster to illustrate a pair of words that sound the same but mean different things. On one side of my poster board, I draw a red and white striped ball. On the other, the face of a child, pale, pink, eyes squinted, tears spurting out across the poster. Curly hair, like mine. I shiver. What have I drawn? How is it possible for one sound to do that? To have one meaning that rises while the other falls like a schoolyard seesaw? And this, though I knew it not then, this metaphor for the life to come, a seemingly bland, perfect sphere, a toy, potential for joy, watered by woe. My editor really liked that poem. He likes it a lot more than I like it. I mean, I like it. I love the memory of it and the play with language and all, but he wanted me to call the book Watered by Woe, and I was like, I don't think so.
Oh, the title is taken by Lisa M. Miller, Woe and All.
Oh, yes, that's right. That's right. Fun poet, Lisa.
Yeah.
Really talented.
So how did you arrive at this title?
This title came from, you can kind of find references to goat-footed gods or the goat-footed god, which is Pan, all over the, you know, all over the world, internet, whatever, libraries. And so all I really did was put an S on it because I'm talking about all sorts of religions, including the Judeo-Christian religion as well.
And our own mythologies also.
Yes, yes, of course, yeah.
And for the listeners of Accents, Kathleen was, is, will always be my mentor. my writing teacher, and I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for all that I've learned from her over the years. Let me mention a few things that I've learned. And it's not always obvious to us what others are learning from us, right?
Absolutely. I'm interested to hear what you have to say.
Well, I just wrote a couple of things. No, three things. One is that I've seen you relaxed and smiling during all sorts of circumstances, like levity in potentially stressful times. How do you stay so calm?
Oh, my goodness. I'm not sure. You know, I guess maybe at one time in my life I wasn't. You met me at the right time.
Okay.
Even though we go back a little way, you met me at the right time. I think it's just experience, you know, and trusting yourself and knowing that at some point, you know, living with uncertainty, knowing that you've gotten through something before and you'll get through something again. So, you know, I always say I'm just working toward wisdom. So that's my goal. So I really think, you know, I've like all people, I've had stresses and anxiety and situations happen. And I'm sort of built to be optimistic as well. So that's the best answer I have for you.
That's a great one. Thank you. And then being able to attend to your own writing and professional career through busy times. How do you manage to keep it a priority? Many people I know, myself included, tend to get distracted since it's easier to work on other people's things.
It is easier to work on other people's things. It is easier to be distracted. But it's easy to get excited. I teach, and so it's very easy to get excited about student work and helping them and seeing potential in something and wanting to give them everything. But, you know, at the heart of this, the reason I do all this, because I'm a writer and I'm built like a writer, it's not something I can separate really from myself. So if I'm not writing, or if I haven't written for a while, I don't feel like myself. I can feel physically, you know, in my being that, you know, I need to get back to my work. So I remember that why I did this in the first place. You know, I love teaching. It is a calling of mine, but I found it through writing. And so that's foundational for me. It's the way I operate in the world. So I need to keep that strong and that muscle strong. I don't sit down as much as I used to, but when I sit down, I'm ready to write. Whereas before, and there's no right way to do this. I mean, everybody has their own style. But I remember Sina Jeter Naslin, who's the founder of Naslin Man. Her name's in the title of the school where I teach and chair the program, the MFA program. She used to talk about making appointments with herself. And so she would show me her appointment book. She had a paper book, you know, of calendar. And she would have big places marked out, and they would be, you know, with a big X through them. And that was her sacred time for writing. And so I took that lesson. I don't think that's always the way people write. We brought in a distinguished visiting writer for the spring residency, which we just finished at Spalding. And her name is Nina LaCour, and she is a wonderful writer. She mainly writes YA, and so we had her book in common. Watch Over Me was her book in common. But she had a Q&A with us, and it was fascinating. The students, I just saw them come alive when she started talking about this. She started saying that, or talking about the fact that she stopped writing on the computer, stopped composing on the computer, stopped drafting, because, and this seems antithetical, but it makes so much sense to me, and maybe it will to you too, you know, is that it took her longer to write that way, because she would stop, edit, back up, go forward, you know, cut things, paste things, whatever. And then also, you know, you have email popping through all the time. So years ago, and she makes her living by her writing. She teaches here and there, but that's how she makes her salary. She decided to just start writing by hand. And she doesn't make herself write chronologically, but she has a notebook with her all the time. This is something I've seen Frank X. Walker do. I've always thought about this, a wonderful poet from Kentucky, carry around a notebook. And I've seen him jot down things. And I thought, oh, well. But I've started doing this too a little bit, and it's kind of very freeing. Particularly if I'm working in essays, which seem very large to me. So I don't make myself work chronologically. I just write the passage that I want to write. I write it in a notebook now. And what she does, which was my stumbling block before when I tried to write by hand, what she does is before, you know, many people write by hand and do this, and then they type up after they're done. And that just seems so insurmountable. And I don't feel excited about something, you know, a month later. So every day after she gives herself a certain amount of time to write, every day she goes and she types it up on the computer.
That same day?
Yep.
Wow, that's commitment.
Yeah. Yeah, well, she figures that into part of her time. So say she has 3 hours to write, she'll draft for 2 hours, and then she'll put it in the computer. And then she might make little changes at the time and maybe shape things up a little bit. But at least when she's putting it and starting to do that initial shaping up of it, she's real excited about it. You know how it is. I always say, I love the poem most that I'm with, right? So you're most excited about things that they have to be going somewhat well. But if something's going well and you're working on it, you really love that. I think most writers are like that. I'm not like most writers in a lot of ways, but I think most writers are like that. So I just thought it was freeing. And the students just sat up and were asking questions, and it was a revelation, really. So,
well, I don't know anybody else who has such process.
Yeah.
You know, if anybody really, really, really wants to write, sounds like they're going to find a process that works for them, no?
Right. I think so. But I don't know. Like you say, it's so easy to get distracted, and it's so easy to get down on yourself if you haven't written for a while, and it's, you know, your life takes you in another direction. And you know, I've been talking about this a little bit as being poet laureate, but, you know, writing is not just a thing we do. It's a way of being. And it's a way to sort of find your authentic self and deepen your human experience and reflection about things, especially in a world when we're yanked so many ways. So I think it takes many, many, many hours to become a great writer. But I think writing can help you have a great life, you know, even if you don't put in all those hours, because of what it brings to you, your experience, you know, how it makes you think about the imagination and creativity and language and all of those things that make us human and connect us to each other. I mean, what is language but something that connects us to each other?
Language connects us to each other, but it also connects us to ourselves.
Right.
And getting to
Absolutely.
Know me, getting to know myself better and understanding my own reactions and my own desire, if
yes.
you will, that has really helped me spare myself miles and miles and years walking in the wrong direction.
That's right. Well, another thing that I often say to students, which I don't know if I have ever said to you, is we write what we don't know we know. And I think that's kind of what you're expressing there, or what I think you're expressing there. Yeah. You know, when we write it down, we're like, oh.
Of course.
I'm always like, oh, did I think that? Or am I like that? Well, of course I am. Or, wow, am I like that?
So, you were recently appointed as the 2025-2026 Kentucky Poet Laureate. How has your life changed since then?
Well, I've been palling around with Governor Beshear more. I'm just kidding. But I have, actually. He was, as I said, he was at Saturday's commencement. And he was so present, let's say, on Kentucky Writers' Day. So it's been kind of a thrill. I mean, it would have been a thrill anyway. But to be appointed by someone like him is just icing on the cake for me. It makes me smile all the time. But I'm busier, you know, and I've had to think it took me a while, but people kept asking me, like, what's your vision? And I was like, I got to have a vision? Nobody told me I had to have a vision. I said, I've got projects, but my vision, I finally realized, is kind of like it's always been, you know, to connect one writer with another, try to share information, try to share things that I know. But also, it's a little selfish. I mean, a lot of teachers, and maybe being Kentucky Poet Laureate is like that. I mean, you know, I love learning. I love looking at other people's work and thinking about other people's work. So it gives me more opportunities to do that across the state. I mean, not to be too fresh about it, but it just means I'm a lot busier. I want to go into high schools. I'm either Zoom into high schools or go in person if schedules allow for that. But what I really want to do is read with the writing teachers in high school, because I want high school kids to understand that their writing teachers are also writers, that they came into this for this reason. I mean, I bet you if you have a writing teacher, the writing teacher, before the writing teacher thought about being a writer teacher, was thinking about being a writer too. So, and what great work. And, you know, I like to do that. I like to read with students. I think I want to, I know that community, I know, there are not a lot of things I know, but I know that communities that embrace the arts are stronger communities. So I'd like to go into communities and read, not just read my own work, but read with other people, share the podium with other people, and hear what they have to say. I'm doing this pilot in the park that figures into some of my poems. This park's really important to me. It's about 5 minutes away from my house, and I'm there a lot. And it's called Walk and Write with the Kentucky Poet Laureate. And so we're going to take a hike on this hike that I do many times. I've done it many, many times. And we're going to use our cameras and our notebooks and sort of just, you know, take notes and images and things. And because we all know from the ancient, even from the ancients, but people still talk about it, that walking in nature helps foster and improve creativity and imagination. It's true. When I need a poem sometimes, or I'm feeling like I need to write, I take this trail. I've done it many times, and it never fails that I have to walk about, I don't know, 3/10 of a mile, and there's a bend that comes around, and then my mind just engages. And then I'll just talk into my phone with images, or I'll stop with my notebook, and I'll write, and it never fails. And so I want to help other people experience that if I can.
What sweet thing, what privilege to take us into your creative world.
Yeah,
thank you.
Sure.
And it wouldn't be a conversation with Kathleen Driscoll if I don't ask her about the Sina Jeter Karen Mann Graduate School of Writing at Spalding University in Louisville. So how are things at the MFA?
Good. Busy. Most of my colleagues right now at Spalding, faculty colleagues particularly, are like getting ready to go off for the summer, and this is our busiest time of year. So I'm like, I don't want to hear about your vacation. But it's work, but it's good work. It's really great work. So we just finished, as I said, the summer residency where students come for a week, Saturday to Saturday, and we do workshops and lectures and readings and do arts events and reflect upon those. Then they go into their mentored part of the semester, which we call the independent study. And in about 10 days, we're going into our virtual summer residency. So we're going to do everything virtually. We started this when COVID happened because we had to. We found we could do it pretty well, do programming pretty well. So it's synchronous. So it's, you know, you're sitting in front of the computer quite a bit, but it's live, and we're having real conversations with each other. So it's quite wonderful. So students started asking, you know, can you do this? Can you do this? And so we said, well, we can try it. So this is our second year of presenting the virtual residency, and we're double our number of students who want it. And it, you know, a lot of people can't get to Louisville, or you know, there's some expense with traveling, and so. It makes it more accessible. Students can come and get the same degree as the brick-and-mortar students, and there's no distinction. We don't make any distinction. In fact, you could decide something's happening this summer. I can't come to spring, but I can go to summer virtual, and then you can come back and go on in person. So, you know, you can mix and match, too.
So wonderful flexibility, and the same mentors, I assume.
Yes, yes.
Awesome.
Yeah, there's not a faculty A and faculty B. We all teach.
Well, name a few of the faculty members.
Let's see. Maggie Smith, who's probably one of the best-known poets nationally right now and is on tour with Dear Writer, which is a book, sort of craft essays on inspirations for writers. She's a member of our faculty. Silas House, my friend Silas. He's a graduate of Naslin Mann, and when he graduated, we hired him right away. He's a fiction writer. Angela Jackson Brown is a fiction writer. She's another alum that we hired right away, and she, wonderful, wonderful teacher, and really writes quickly in many books that are wonderful. So writing for children, Leslia Newman, I always call her the OG of writing for children.
She is the OG. Yes.
Yeah, I think she's the most banned children's writer in America right now. She's was originally her first book that she became known for was Heather Has Two Mommies. And let's see, who else? Lee Martin, who also teaches at Ohio State, and he's a creative nonfiction and a fiction writer. He's come on board with us. Wonderful teacher, really generous. All these people are generous. So let's see. Playwrights, Kira Obolinsky, who's an amazing playwright. She teaches playwriting. Bruce Marshall Romans is one of the most active screenwriters in the writing room in L.A. right now. And it's so hard to get really good screenwriting faculty because they can make so much more money. But he's still working. He's constantly working on new streaming projects. But he also just wants to teach, and he's connected to Louisville. So,
well, you say he wants to teach, but I would think that people not only teach there, the teachers also learn from one another. Mm-hmm. And all the plenary lectures, you cannot not learn cross-genre.
Right. Right. Well, I've noticed since I started as associate program director there in 2003, and then when Sina retired in 2017, I rose up as the leader of the program. But I have noticed, so I've been there a while, and what I've noticed is that many people are still writing in their genre that they were hired in to teach, but they're also writing in other areas too. And the other thing that's just fabulous is that some of them are writing with their former students too, which I just think is amazing. So it's a very welcoming, warm community without a lot of boundaries, I think, in a good way.
And as you said, you're writing also essays.
Yes, right. Well, I turned to my colleagues to help teach me how to do that. So that's the first place I turned.
So what are you writing now?
I'm trying to work on a book of essays right now. I've written a couple that had some success. And so, I don't know, it gave me sort of the hubris to think that I could write a book of essays. So
I have no doubt you can write a book of
essays.
Well,
we'll see.
You probably have written it already.
No, I haven't. I absolutely haven't. But I'm writing about being part of, well, some of the same subjects that I'm treating in my poems, like being part of the white flight to the next county over from Louisville when busing was finally, when Louisville finally said, you know, Uncle, we will bus our students to integrate our schools. It took Louisville longer than most places. We were one of the last. We had more sort of court stays than anyone else. So, you know, you heard about the busing riots in Boston, and ours were many years later in the mid-70s, too. So so I'm writing about that move out there and the fact that we moved to a little subdivision called Confederate Estates, which is just shocking to me. It's like nobody's trying to hide this too much. Ostensibly, it was called that because there was a graveyard of Confederate soldiers in Piwee Valley that the housing subdivision sort of butted up against. But I'm not thinking that that's really what that was about.
So there is a question that I ask all my guests who teach creative writing. And, you know, and the answer changes.
Yeah.
The answer changes, so feel free to change your answer. And for the record, I haven't gone to look up what was your last.
It's okay, yeah. Because I wouldn't have any idea what I said.
Okay. So the question is, what is the most important thing you teach your students? If there is one thing you want them to remember from your class, what is it?
Well, if I'm thinking generally about all of the spotting students, I think it's to read deeply. I don't think you can even, I think learning to read is a lifelong process. So that I had a conversation with Silas a while ago. We were texting each other about something that he had sent me, and I was like, yeah, sometimes I think our whole job is just to teach students, our writing students, our creative writing students, our whole job is just to teach them how to read better and better and better and better. So, I probably haven't talked about that before. I don't know if I have or not, but.
Would you like to read us a closing poem?
Sure. I think I'll read a poem that's called The Trestle is Haunted. because I think it figures into some things I was talking about earlier. The trestle is haunted. The trestle is haunted by a goat man. He is not carrying a Bible, nor any sacred book, nor is he wearing a priest's collar. He's not wearing clothes at all. His eyes are not blue like Jesus's. He has no hair, though he is covered in fur, and gnats circle his head and horns like a gnarly halo. Some say he swings a bloody axe. Have you seen a photo of goats sleeping in trees? Or the video of a goat walking upright through the streets of India, like a man? Then you may be able to see what is not there, too, at the trestle. What is not there is what'll kill you, knock you dead into the field below, from the trestle tall as an 8-story building, which is also not there, but is nonetheless as deadly to fall from.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's always fun.
I appreciate you making the time to talk to me today.
Always. You always.